Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Rick returns to the show next Sunday. Live Arts Radio produces original radio drama written by the members of the Playwrights Lab and performed by Charlottesville actors. With us in studio this morning are Nathan Andereth.
Hey, Dan.
Nathan is the co-founder of Live Arts Radio. He has been directing, acting, and producing theater for 18 years, from Shakespeare on the Lawn at UVA to drama groups in West Africa. And Corey Caprone. Corey has written three full-length plays and several shorts, directed and co-directed several shows, and worked in props, sound, costume, and creature design. I hope we have some time to talk about that. He is a founding member of the Gorilla Theater Productions, where he has worked as the house composer on many productions. Outside the theater, Corey is a short story author, a singer-songwriter, and occasionally an experimental filmmaker. Good morning to you both.
Good to see you, Dan. Morning.
So, Nathan, I'd like to start with you. Let's talk about the genesis of Live Arts Radio. Where did the original idea come from?
Well, the original idea came from, I was working with the Playwrights Lab, which is this wonderful workshop that's based out of Live Arts, and it's just a group of local playwrights that meet every 2 weeks, and they put their work out there, and they do cold readings, and we listen to them, enjoy them, critique them, develop them, and there's some real talent in this town. But the thing about writing for plays is that the ideal, you know, the end goal of any given play is to actually be produced, and that's pretty difficult. It's quite an elaborate affair, and so the vast majority of these amazing scripts and brilliant concepts pretty much never went past the cold reading stage. I'd been really interested in getting into podcasts. I love podcasts. I have no music on my phone, only podcasts. I've been trying to figure out how I could get something started. And so I saw all these great folks, and then I met Elizabeth Schoenborn, who runs the Ravensworth Studio. I met her outside of a bar one evening, and she started talking about what she did, and just to light bulb came off. So I brought these two great resources together, and it flew off from there.
So you mentioned that you have more podcasts on your phone than you have music.
I have no music, podcasts.
What do you like? What do you like out there in podcast land?
Well, the direct inspiration for Live Arts Radio is a podcast known as The Truth. And they're an anthology of radio plays, very similar to what we do, that are usually about 20 minutes long, and they'll explore some interesting idea or concept. They go from humorous stories to creepy things, to historical things, to highly experimental projects. And every time it's new adventure, and every time it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy that a lot.
So who are some of the other co-founders of the project, and what did each of them contribute to get this thing off the ground?
Let's see. Alex Citrone, I think a lot of people will know as kind of one of the lead playwriting and theater development folks in Charlottesville. He is one of the founders and the moderators of the Playwrights Lab. And so he served as a guiding voice and as well as a connector with the lab. Sean McCord was another co-founder. He brought us our amazing producer. that's you. And he also brought us, he brought a lot of technical knowledge in terms of the specific aspects of how to do the post-production and how to put it together, which is something that I had never done before on a podcast.
And how long did it take to go from this germ of an idea to first day in the recording studio?
Probably about 4 months or so.
And talk about that process.
Well, first we had to, come together with the concept. We had to bring the various stakeholders together, talk about terms, things like that. Then we solicited plays from the lab, got about 10 great scripts, went through a panelment process, picked the one that we really thought would pop the most as a first episode, which I think we're going to hear later in this hour. Loves a Racket, and then as the director for the first episode, I put together a cast. We rehearsed, for about a month and a half or so, so probably a total of about 16 to 18 hours to really get every part of it right down, and then went into the recording studio.
So just switching over to Corey for a bit here. You have composed all the original music for the project, including the theme song, which we'll hear leading into Love's a Racket later in this show. How did you guys get connected? Did you know each other before the project? Or?
We started out on some projects, I guess, with Gorilla, and just were kind of all, really, I think, actually started with Live Arts and Master and Margarita.
Yes.
Lauren was Margarita, and my ex-wife was the demon in the play, and so the cast parties kind of put together kind of a core group of sort of the, you know, many of them gone on to do other stuff, but at the time we were kind of all the scrappy avant-garde people that wanted to do weird theater, so we all bonded together for that production and then just kept working with each other whenever we could.
So tell me a little bit about the process. You wrote the original music for the theme. Mm-hmm. Tell me how does that work? How do you get from nothing to an original theme?
Masochism. Because I had a garage band on my computer, and a project needed a sound. And I was like, well, I have the software, I'll figure it out. And then another project needed a little melody, and then it just kept escalating until 5 years later. I'm like, wow, I've done a lot of music. So really it just starts with I create a loop, and the track just keeps repeating, and I drop a note in, and then it goes boop, boop, boop. And you add another note, boop, boop. And then you stretch the note, and then eventually some of those notes just line up, and apparently they're called chords. And but yeah, it's just hours, because I'm not a classically trained composer, it's just hours of repeating, and then you have that 4 bars, and then you do the next 4 bars, and on, and maybe you do 6-8, maybe you do 3-4, or whatever it requires. But yeah, you just keep doing it until you have something.
And you also performed the original theme, right? You constructed and performed it. Performed it is...
Maybe I told the computer what to do.
Yeah, you built it.
I'm not a musician.
You built it.
Yeah. But yeah, it's... So yeah, basically what would happen is Nathan would go, hey, can you make a theme for this? Sure, when do you need it by? Maybe next week? Are you serious? Okay, cool. And... that's kind of the story of my life, is lots of delightfully short notice things. And then after the deadline, you find out, oh, wait, no, we actually have time to work on this and more. But so you just kind of throw stuff at a wall, panicking, and you then deliver 3 tracks, and then one is picked. And
now, for one of the pieces, Gilligan's, what's that piece called?
No Man is a Gilligan's Island.
No Man is a Gilligan's Island. You also composed a music bed to go with the story. Tell us about... How do you coordinate with the director, and how does that all work out?
With that one, you direct that one, right?
Yes.
Yes. That. So that was pretty easy because we know each other, and so it's just a lot of like texting and messaging and calling and coming over. Mm-hmm. Basically, he laid down some lines like, you know, I want there to be something here, something here, something here. I got the track once it was recorded, and I put it up on one computer, and then on the other computer I had GarageBand up and would play along, and boop, boop, boop.
And so, describe the nature of the bed, what do you say? I want something cool, or I want something lumpy? I mean, how do you talk about a piece of music bed that's never been written yet?
Well, it's tricky, particularly because I don't come from any kind of music background, really. And it's also tricky because we were trying to develop music in a way that neither of us had ever worked on before. Corey has written, you know, gigabytes worth of music, and they're all sitting on his hard drive, but he'd never done anything for a podcast before. And so creating, it was a really interesting challenge, making a background music that supports and fills out the sound without being distracting or overpowering it. And so getting the right feel for it that doesn't evoke the feel but simply supports the emotional arc that the character who's speaking is going through. So there'd be a dramatic moment, and he'd do the classic slowing down, and then there'd be a zippy, funny moment, and then we get a lot of short, quicker pieces. And it was definitely a trial-and-error process.
Yeah, I mean, definitely a lot of my favorite composers kind of come from the school of music as set design or, you know, it's like wallpaper or something. So it should be something that enhances it, but it's not, you know, upstaging anyone.
Nathan Andereth here this morning with us, and Corey Caprone. We're talking about Live Arts Radio. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Nathan, let's talk about cast.
Yeah.
You have to go through a casting process just like
definitely
anybody else does.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, the nice thing about Charlottesville, and to some people kind of the annoying thing, but particularly in the artistic or theater community, it's a very small community. And it really is, though, it's like 10 pounds of talent in a 5-pound bag. Like, there are, you throw a rock downtown and you'll hit some incredibly talented actor or musician or stage designer or something. And if you know one or two people, you know pretty much everybody. And so it was, so it's been really great in this and other projects to be able to just easily reach out a hand and be able to find somebody. And you work enough in this town, you kind of slot people in, slot in your mind. So, like, you know, Corey is a guy I know can do music and film, you know, and I know someone who can do this type of character and acted very well because I've seen them do it at a play, and they can also do dance, you know. And so you kind of always in your head you have this roster of abilities and talents that you have access to, which is a great thing about this town. So generally with these, we don't, so far with Live Arts Radio, we haven't held open auditions. It's simply been a process of speaking with the playwright and talking to them about their vision and then thinking about who we know and then just who we can imagine fitting those roles.
And so when you cast, is an extensive background on stage helpful or
extremely
hurtful?
Well, it's been interesting. So one thing I was really surprised by is just how different it is to direct simply for audio. You know, we always know that blocking is important to visually tell the story, but I was surprised at how much blocking contributes to just the vocal expression that an actor is bringing across. You know, like it's this bit of the Stanislavski method. You evoke anger by clenching your body and changing your face and things like that. And so without that, it was actually fairly difficult. And so a lot of actors who are used to relying on those physical impetuses to evoke a given emotion or concept suddenly didn't have that anymore. And they had to basically learn a whole new type of acting on the fly. Something that was interesting is that for two of the episodes, they had previously been done with that same cast as stage productions. Three of them, actually, including one we're working on right now. And so everyone thought it would be a relatively easy process to just transfer it, go straight from the stage to the radio. And actually, we had to unlearn and kind of rebuild a lot of the habits and a lot of the patterns we built up.
And is that because the emotion of the piece has to be expressed entirely through this one dimension, the voice?
Exactly.
You don't have the face. You don't have the body language.
Right.
So how do you do that? If you have a piece where the body language is on stage and is essential to understanding the purpose of the piece,
yeah,
how do you translate that to radio?
Well, a lot of times it requires some script readjustments. Every one of the scripts that we've done has come in as a really good piece, but has undergone extensive revision throughout the process. The playwrights have been wonderful about being at rehearsals, working with the director, really making the adjustments as necessary to make sure that the story comes across in the new medium. The other element that we've used has been just altering the type of emotions that we can, that we are communicating in such a way so that instead of relying on a facial expression, you're bringing it across in the voice. And that doesn't mean over-emoting. That means really finding the very specific vocal art in terms of your volume, in terms of your inflection. We would get down in rehearsal to almost every single word and exactly how the cadence worked on every one and really polish it to a gleam to a point where we had a really beautiful piece of tape.
Okay, I'd like to move on a little bit to now the recording process. You're in the studio. You record out at Ravensworth Studios.
Yes.
How did you select them?
Well, like I said, they were behind the whole idea of this because I met Elizabeth Schoenborn, and she said she had a space. Ravensworth Studios, they are outside of Scottsville, so about half an hour away, and they have just a beautiful location.
Yes.
Or would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a very comfortable, gorgeous place. I'd love to go back there and record something else.
It's like a little farmstead way out in the forest, and they have this little barn that they spent, I don't know how much money, refitting into this very comfortable, cozy, but, you know, cutting-edge technology recording studio. And they're very excited to work with us because they've done a lot of musical albums. You know, they always have multiple projects going on like that, but this was something new, and it was an opportunity for them to stretch themselves and practice new things. And so it was interesting. It was also a bit of a trial and error process. We found that, for example, we had a big problem with microphones picking up other actors. Even when we were in isolation, you would still hear the bleed through on one actor's microphone from the other, which made the post-production process much more challenging.
And some of that was also, in fairness, having to rewire the space to accommodate simultaneous use. They basically have two primary recording spaces, and we had to make a third space, which they improvise marvelously, but that does take a lot of...
Definitely, yeah. And the type of setups that they're used to record music on is just very different from when you're dealing with a podcast. One of the most fun challenges was during Accountability, which is one of the episodes we'll hear later. We did a number of... sound effects that we had to perform live as part of this sort of regular cadence that had a musical quality but also helped Sounder stand in for the blocking. And so that was really an enjoyable challenge, and I think they'll talk about that once we get to the to that episode. But that was basically sort of inventing on a fly a whole new type of a sound effect and trying to figure out how to make it work in that space with the tools we had.
Now, it's kind of a family business out there, right? Greg and Elizabeth are the proprietors, and it's kind of like a homey kind of setting, isn't it?
Oh, it's lovely, yeah. Greg and Elizabeth live out there, Greg and Elizabeth Schoenborn, and at any given time, they'll have like two or three musicians either living there or having dinner, or, you know, just because people go down there and work for months on these projects, they become kind of part of the family. I got a big old bulldog that everybody loves, has been on multiple album covers. And so, yeah, it's just, you know, when you go in there and work with them, they give you the cup of coffee, you relax, have some food. It doesn't feel like work. It feels like just having a really enjoyable creative session with some very talented and professional people.
Great. Now, we have just a couple of minutes before we need to take a break. I was wondering what you could talk a little bit about what it's like to direct out there.
Well, to be 100% honest, by the time we get to the recording studio, if a director's done his job well, doesn't really have much to do. Basically, at that point, it's more of a producer/stage manager job. You know, make sure everybody has their water. Make sure that everybody's ready to go at the same time. Make sure that communication is 100% clear between Greg Schoenborn, who's doing the technical aspects of it, and the different actors. Make sure if there's any confusion or conflicts that those get resolved quickly and easily. It's that kind of thing.
Yes. And when you do multiple takes, right?
Yes, three takes.
And after do you leave the studio with a sense that you've got it in the can?
No, not remotely. No. You leave the studio thinking, all right, now comes the hard part. Because then comes post-production. So that's a really interesting process where we take the three takes and we listen to them, probably 40, 50 times each, and pick out exactly which lines or, you know, groups of lines are said best in each take. So what you end up with is the absolute best of each take, so it comes out as a much better performance than they could ever have done just straight out.
Basically, it's film editing, essentially.
Yeah. Pretty much exactly like film editing, yeah, except probably a little less complicated than film editing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and so what you end up with is this, you know, then finally you end up with this really nicely rendered, you know, like I said, polished to a sheen piece of tape, and then comes in, like, you know, with Gilligan's Island, we had a laugh track and the background music. We've always got sound effects to work on. We've got all these other little pieces that got to be pieced together. And that's probably a good 8 to 12 hour process, just taking care of that.
So you're in the studio for like 8 hours.
Not me, you.
No. Oh, no, talking about post-production.
Post-production.
Yeah, how long are you in the studio?
Yeah, the producer definitely spends. Yeah, I mean we're definitely learning and getting the process down faster. But yeah, I would probably say all the post production amount of time spent in the studio working on it. Yeah, it's probably 8 to 12 hours or so, and that's for something that ends up being like 10 to 15 minutes worth of tape.
Yeah, right. 20 minutes after the hour, roughly 20 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. When we come back, we'll hear Love's a Racket, Live Arts Radio's first production. Please stay with us. We're back with Nathan Andereth of Live Arts Radio. Nathan, you've brought a couple of podcasts along with you today to share with us.
Absolutely.
Can you set this first one up for us?
All right. So this is our very first episode. It's called Love's a Racket. And we picked it out of all the submissions we got because it was the one that just seemed to really delight in the language. The characters are these highly intellectual people who have gotten caught in an extremely strange and perverse situation that they're trying to reason and rationalize their way out. And the interplay between the two main characters and the daughter is just a delight. And we've had some amazing actors working on it.
And one of those amazing actors is Lauren Gilroy, mm-hmm. who will be with us later, and also Vincent Barbati, who will be with us later. So listen for those. The podcast runs about 13 minutes, after which Vincent and will join us with the playwright, Byron Harris, to talk about the piece. Here's Live Arts Radio and Love's a Racket.
Welcome to Live Arts Radio, bringing you original radio dramas written by members of the Playwrights Lab and performed by Charlottesville actors. This is our pilot episode, and we are introducing ourselves to the world with a surreal comedy of manners and betrayal. We hope you enjoy Love's a Racket by Byron Harris.
Caitlin, why are you sitting in the front hallway wielding my tennis racket?
I indeed. A conundrum for you to solve, Jeffrey.
Something is different.
So it would seem.
The foyer, you've done something.
Aside from moving the leather armchair athwart your path?
Obviously, my favorite armchair bestrides the hall as if 'twere Colossus towering over Rhodes, but there is more. Oh, my dear heart, you've painted the walls completely purple.
I have done so. The majestic teal damask paper no longer suited. Not at all.
So purple.
Purple.
An homage to Kate and William's latest offspring.
Heavens no.
A retrospective on Alice Walker's finest novel.
No, sadly not.
Then rage it is. I've transgressed, crossed some sort of line. A day spent tearing down the wallpaper and slapping on a fresh coat of paint must mean wrath. But what have I done?
How discerning of you, Jeffrey. You tease out profits investing in Kazakh Airlines, electric cars in Malaysia, and tin mines in Chile. Yet you're so easily stumped in your very home. So disappointing.
Perhaps you will choose to enlighten me.
Perhaps you will unearth the cause yourself. You've done so well so far.
Thinking, thinking. Must you swing that racket about so wildly?
What, this old thing? Are you afraid I might hit you with it?
No, that's absurd, but, well, that's a barbalot. You should stop. You might...
I might what?
You might damage it.
And why would that be a problem? Polly never plays in the barbalot, only gathers dust in the bin.
It's rather expensive.
We're rich.
It's finely made.
As was the sateen weave on the walls, but you don't seem overly worried about that.
It's... dear to me.
Ah, there's the rub. Owning the problem is the beginning. We must discuss you and your unhealthy attachment to this tennis racket tonight.
I'm quite at sea as to what you might mean, Caitlin.
Jeffrey, it has come to my attention that you might be sleeping with this thing.
I couldn't conceive how such a thing could come to pass.
You couldn't conceive the idea of sleeping with a racket or the means.
Either, neither. Both.
The truth should not be so difficult, my love. A simple yea or nay would suffice.
There's that rub all over again, Caitlin. I find this truth of yours to be excessively mercurial.
Truth is truth, Jeffrey. The rub remains the rub.
But, Caitlin, I love you with every fiber of my being.
That thrills me, Jeffrey, to my very bones. But you do seem to be, shall we say, prevaricating.
I love it when you talk rhetoric, dear heart. But to my mind, I'm being most forthcoming.
Are you? Perhaps hedging best describes your behavior. Do speak honestly, Jeffrey.
Truth seems to me to be overrated.
In what way?
I have found in my 43 years on this planet that I've often desired the truth, or thought I did, but then didn't appreciate what I found when I found it.
Is this yet another elaborate machination to avoid discussing your distasteful association with said tennis racket?
Maybe so, but I do find you stunningly beautiful.
Then let me offer you another word, equivocate. And, Geoffrey, I perceive beauty to be overrated.
How so?
Too often beauty gets confused with mere pulchritude, which entails the outer shell, the surface manifestation. True beauty runs soul deep.
I didn't know you to be so philosophical.
Having discovered one's husband to be a possible philanderer with an inanimate object can lead one to a wiser path.
Caitlin, has this endeavor been good for you?
In this case, goodness.
I know, overrated.
Actually, nuanced. It fairly craves truth, Geoffrey. The two go hand in hand in the long road.
Are we as a family better off for you bringing this absurd charge against me? Or are you plunging us all into an artificial crisis, a veritable whirlpool of self-sabotage and angst?
Either. Both. The truth will out. It always does. And then I can answer your query more completely. Polly, can you come here for a moment, dear?
Yes, Mother.
Polly, can you tell me what this is?
If I'm not mistaken, that would be my old tennis racket.
Can you be more specific?
I believe it is a Babolat AeroPro Drive, said to be one of the finest tennis rackets ever made.
Indeed, only the very best for my esteemed daughter.
No tampering of the witness, if you will. And, Polly, why were you given this racket?
If memory serves, the Babolat was a gift for my 9th birthday. I believe the expectation was that I'd pick up the game like a fish in water and rise quickly to fame and fortune on the junior circuit before making a big splash at the U.S. Open and perhaps Wimbledon.
Was this ever a likely outcome?
No. It was a fantastical projection of my father. I proved to be terrified of the ball and kept ducking when people hit it my way.
How did your father take this?
With my usual grace and aplomb, I'm sure.
Not well. I believe my maladroitness shocked him, humiliated the man to his core. He kept taking me to the backyard to hit balls against the retaining wall.
And how did that go?
Not well. My pernicious wall always won.
Geoffrey, do you have any questions?
A few. Polly, won't you agree the Babolat was a classy gift, intended only to improve your confidence, fitness, and general self-esteem?
Father, this infernal device was foisted upon me so as to exasperate and crush my soul into ashes. Of that I have no doubt.
I see. Be that as it may, have you ever seen me touch this racket in what could be construed in any way, shape, or form as inappropriate?
I have seen you swing it about wildly in the backyard.
Can you be more specific?
After one of our pathetic sessions, I saw you pick up the racket to serve, acting as if you were playing match point in a Grand Slam tourney up 40-love against Federer.
So, a harmless bit of daydreaming. Anything else?
You did kill the spider. Most viciously, I might add.
That act was in self-defense of my family, as you well know. A man in his castle and all that.
I saw you strip down to your tighty-whities, turn the speakers up to an extraordinary volume, and play the racket as if a guitar. Song? After song, after song.
I thought you were at Sally's house that day.
I came back early. It was quite the show, I must say.
Still, no real damage. Just your father being a bit foolish. You survived the ordeal, I see.
Yes, she did, but even so, in summary, Polly, your father willfully inflicted the Babolat upon you as a quote-unquote gift at a tender age that led to trauma upon trauma. Since you laid the dreaded artifact aside in great despair, you've witnessed your father in a variety of awkward settings with said item. This created even more bad feelings about yourself, which will, indubitably, lead to years of pricey counseling and lifelong ennui.
You're speaking for her, testifying, not adjudicating, putting words in her mouth, as the vulgar might say.
Yes, she is. But I think her pithy speech captures the whole affair nicely. You seem to care more for the Babolat than your own progeny.
Thank you, Polly, for your integrity in the face of great familial pressure.
Can I depart now? Need you any further testimony in this contretemps?
Please do, and speak of this dispute to no one.
I shall be the very embodiment of discretion. Fare thee well.
I don't believe your indictment holds, yet I have something I need to say.
Then, please, feel free to spill your guts.
Must you use such violent imagery as we discuss the moral turpitude of this world?
It seemed an apt phrase to reflect your seeming confessional mode. Continue.
Regardless, perhaps the tennis racket and I slipped up, and I did sleep the night away, cradling my precious Babolat in my arms.
I knew it. Oh, I just knew it. A woman always knows when her man strays.
Stray seems a strong turn of phrase.
Stray works. Stray works just fine.
If you say so.
I do say so.
It was just the one time.
So you say.
Exactly. So I say.
How could you? You're a wealthy hedge fund manager with so much to lose. Suppose it were to let slip to your stakeholders that the captain of their ship has a thing for things.
That would be decidedly bad. It's just this magnificent racket, this Babolat. Did you know that it has a wing shaft design second to none?
No.
That the woofer grommets make for stronger ball pocketing and what the manufacturer likes to call the trampoline effect?
No, no, I did not.
And that the new Cortex Active Expert version better dampens bad vibrations while giving a player maximum ball feel.
No, this is all new to me.
These things aren't just wooden catgut anymore, I tell you. These rackets changed the sport, took away the smart players who rushed the nets out, and left us watching these robots roaming the baseline set after set after set. What happened to the game of tennis? It was crushed by technology.
That's a mouthful.
Schumpeter would be proud. Creative destruction at its best.
You seem invigorated.
I am. I have a lot of pent-up feelings to express. This racket is a feat of engineering that turned an industry on its head. The Babolat and its ilk became the deciders. You either had the athleticism and power to wield this, or you didn't, and you were out of the game.
Sounds horrible.
'Twas wonderful. All this done by some R&D nerds testing out designs on computer simulations and tweaking the tensile strength of graphite and tungsten. There's the rub, Caitlin. An entire world smashed asunder by a mere racket.
I did not realize.
It's beautiful, like a killer whale, an orca. There is this vicious purity to the Babolat. I think I envy it. Strong quarterly returns don't shake the world to its knees.
This racket intrigues you. Why don't you just buy the company?
I don't care about tennis, one whit. It's this racket that challenges me, drives me to leave a mark in the world.
A mark or a gash? Do you want to burn Rome? Take the shot from the grassy knoll? Is it better to have people recall your manifold virtues or the destruction left in your path?
I have in me greatness. I held this racket close to my chest so as to imbue that fragile essence of the sublime. You style yourself a philosopher. Does the sublime not resonate?
Sublime can be defined as both awe-inspiring and terrifying. You would be that, a destroyer, and have us all bow down before you.
Yes! Maybe.
Can I suggest another path? You have in you goodness, and it's good to be good. The world overvalues the lead wolf. You're being pulled against yourself. Be a dog, Jeffrey. Be content to be good.
That feels like surrendering. If anything, I am that alpha male prowling the deep woods.
Come in from the woods, then. The world needs some renunciation. I find greatness to be overrated.
You've given me much to consider. You were wise to confront me about the Babolat.
Then my answer to your earlier question will stand as yes. I do feel seeking the truth to be the right thing. The rub's the rub. Always.
I'm only considering your proposition, my love. Greatness yet beckons.
As do I. I beckon you, Jeffrey. Consider the lapse forgiven. Besides, I now know you better, my love. It's something of an inventio for me.
Oh, Caitlin, do talk the talk.
Dispositio.
Don't stop. All five canons.
Elocutio.
Oh, Caitlin, you are the one.
Memoria.
Oh, Caitlin, wait, what's to be done with the racket?
Leave it. Be good.
For now, where were we?
Pronunciatio.
Love's a Racket was written by Byron Harris and performed by Vincent Barbati, Lauren Gilroy, and Lisa Weigold. It was produced by Dan Gould and directed by me, Nathan Andereth. Production help from Sean McCord and Alex Citrone. Theme music composed by Corey Caprone. Recording was done at the excellent Ravensworth Studio with the assistance of Greg and Elizabeth Schoenborn. Many thanks to Live Arts Theater for its help and guidance. This has been a Playwrights Lab production.
We're back on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Joining us to talk about the piece we just heard are Vincent Barbati. Vincent played the role of Jeffrey in the podcast you just heard. And according to his bio, this is his 37th podcast, if one includes imaginary podcasts, and his first podcast, if one does not. And Byron Harris. He started out at Live Arts Playwrights Lab some 5 years ago, and has had his readings and productions, and has had readings and productions of his work in and around Central Virginia. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Byron, let's start with you, because every production essentially starts with the written word. So you wrote this piece we just heard. How did it come to be? How did you get started on it?
It was a assignment in a short forms course that I take, working on my MFA from Hollins University in playwriting, and it was a writing prompt. We were supposed to apply to various theater companies with short pieces, 10-minute pieces, and an Akron theater company had this as a prompt: write a play with a tennis racket. So that's the origin.
And did you model it after any other kind of genre that you had in your mind from, you know, previous work you had done, or how does the idea form?
Ideas are easy for me. Execution's really hard. I didn't really have a specific model. I had been intrigued with the tennis racket issue within the sport. I don't play tennis. I know people who do, but I do not. But I'd followed it, and somehow these arch, strange people came into my head arguing over it. The language of tennis also, love. There's so many evocative jargon that's associated with sport. So it just kind of... something kind of welled up, and suddenly I was typing.
Now, there's a certain cadence to the piece. Does that come from you, or does that come from the actors?
It's the piece as submitted. We did some extensive rewrites. Nathan had a lot of ideas. I have some excellent readers, Carol Peterson, Patrick Cribben, who all gave me ideas. And it became... the shape of it changed a bit, particularly the beginning in the rewrite process. And the voices, you know, this arch kind of strange couple, their dysfunction and their artifice kind of grew and grew as the piece kind of went through rewrites.
Vincent, you played the part of Jeffrey in this piece we just heard. Was this your first voice radio play?
It definitely was, and it was an incredible experience and somewhat unnerving one. I've done a lot of stage acting. That's how I ran into Nathan and Lauren, who plays Caitlin in the piece, and was used to doing that. And I always figured it would be a fairly easy transition. I have a decent voice. I've practiced using it, but it was a whole new ball game as far as that went. We had to learn a lot of new microphone techniques, and it felt for quite a while like acting in a straitjacket, since you don't have the physical mannerisms or the ability to move around as much as you would during a stage show. And Byron was super helpful, because obviously the piece was originally written for the stage and had a lot of things that we were having trouble evoking using radio techniques. So he did several rounds of rewrites, which is the opposite of what happens in most productions, where it's a challenge to even change a small article in a sentence, as opposed to, hey, could you change your entire plot to better suit our needs?
So we were talking earlier with Nathan about the difference between acting on stage and voice acting. You've done stage work before. You've done this. I'm trying to get a picture of what it's like to be in the studio. Can you see the other actors?
You can. So in the Ravensworth, the studio where we do the actual recording, it's a gorgeous place where I would live if I could. And I'm seriously considering a career in voice, if anyone will have me. But they have this lovely large room primarily for musical recording, with a couple of microphones that are suspended, and you have stands in front of you. For most of the recording of Love is a Racket, Lisa and Lauren were in that room. And then I was just right off on the side in a separated booth so that I didn't resonate too much on their mic. But you have large glass windows. You can see each other and react a little bit. It's just unusual being immobile while you do it.
We need to take a short break, after which we'll be back. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. When we come back, we'll hear Live Arts Radio perform their newest piece, Accountability. Please stay with us. We're back with Lauren Gilroy. Lauren is a stage actor who also played the character Caitlin in the first piece we heard earlier this morning. She also directed the play Accountability, which we'll hear in a moment. Lauren, good morning.
Good morning, Dan. Thanks for having us.
Lauren, I need you to just kind of cozy up to that mic a little bit, get about that distance from it, and we'll be good to go.
All right. Am I all better?
Perfect. We've taken two segments out of Accountability, and just for purposes of being able to fit them in this morning, can you set us up with this first piece?
Yes, Accountability is an office dramedy with a supernatural twist. I'm not going to spoil it until you've gotten to know the characters a little bit, but you will notice that they have some unusual names.
All right. We're about to hear two segments from Accountability, and here's the first one from Live Arts Radio, Part 1, Accountability.
We have any coffee left?
I made a pop this morning before you came in.
You are a goddess. A perky, chirpy goddess.
Late night?
No idea. It's mostly a series of flashes. Karaoke, shots, tiny cowboy hats. I think I challenged a bartender to arm wrestle. Then belly buttons, then fade to black.
Belly buttons?
You'd be amazed how much tequila your typical white trash girl's belly button can hold. She was a skinny little thing, too, so it was concave. Less a belly button shot, more a saucer. Wasn't even good tequila, but all the guys were cheering and daring me. I didn't have much of a choice. Went home with one of them, though, so it worked out.
Leticia, sometimes I wish I could spend one night the way you spend your whole life. Then I think that night would probably...
Kill you.
Leave me passed out and pregnant in a Taco Bell bathroom.
Pregnant? Clotho?
Well, no. You know what I mean.
You should at least wake up with more piercings than you started with.
I'm always amazed you can scrape yourself off the floor and drag yourself to work.
Hey, it's the job. If I didn't come in... Can you imagine what would happen if I missed a day?
That would be a problem.
Putting it mildly.
Speaking of painful, soul-killing work, how was your weekend, Clotho? Went to that big management conference?
Yes, it was great. I did a lot of great networking, pressed a lot of palms. I was able to give my elevator pitch to some of the key stakeholders and got some crucial FaceTime. The presentation killed. The manager met me afterward and told me what a great job we did.
We? Me and Atropos didn't do anything on that presentation.
I made a slide. It said, thank you for listening. Any questions? It really added something, I think.
Well, it doesn't matter. The point is that we're being recognized for all our work. And hey, this isn't official yet, but the manager wanted me to tell you that we can expect a surge in new accounts from emerging markets.
Kill me now.
Guys, this is good news. Emerging markets are a key source of growth.
Clotho, emerging markets have always been a source of growth. That's what they do, emerge. How many new accounts did we just get from China last quarter? We're buried alive in paperwork over here. No, not we. Me. You keep opening accounts like Catholic Rabbit, and Atropos is taking longer to close them. So it piles up on my desk like a Malthusian mudslide. I spend my weekends processing accounts when I should be slurping Cuervo out of a meth head's emaciated belly.
I try to close them faster, just to get them off my desk. But those stubborn little accounts, they keep applying for extensions, like scurrying cockroaches.
And that's a good thing. Look, guys, I know we've all been putting in a lot of extra time recently, but it's been paying off. You saw our last quarterly numbers. They were great. Open accounts are at an all-time high, KPIs are in the green, quarterly figures are up 15% year on year. Reviews are in, and customer satisfaction is... Well, they don't know how good they've got it. But operating margins are up 50 basis points.
Sometimes, when you talk, I think of a hand puppet gopping its thumb up and down while CNBC plays in the next room.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
Come on, I know I'm not the only one who still cares about this job. Our throughput has been fantastic.
Throughput. I like that. We put them through. a river of revenue sliding solemnly through and through the system until they were put.
A morbid march of market share.
A trend line of tears.
A funnel of fixed assets?
No.
A cavalcade of cash converted...
It's cute when Clotho tries to be a real person.
Converted to common stock with contributed capital committed to cost of goods sold.
Did that mean anything?
No.
Everyone has a guess.
It's true.
For that, I deserve coffee.
Oh, my weekend? Thanks for asking. On Saturday, I arranged all of my clothes by shade of black, then made elaborate social plans, then bailed on each one of them. It was exquisite. I even cropped them out of a day planner that I found in the trash. Then Sunday, I did nothing at all.
You better slow down this crazy roller coaster ride you're on, Atropos.
Is that why you've been leaving work early so often this past month? Because of your packed social calendar?
It's hard being so adored by the masses.
Oh yes, they all love you. Everyone who meets you just has the nicest things to say.
No, they don't.
Sorry.
I don't care.
What about that guy you were seeing a while back?
He's gone.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We just heard a bit of accountability. Lauren, we've got another piece of that coming up.
Yes, so the most sharp-eared of our listeners who remember all of their Greek myths will recognize the names of the three fates, Atropos, Clothos, and Lachesis. And the plot of the story is that the three fates are three women working in an office and running the affairs of the entire world. The next clip is going to explore a little bit of how they interact when something goes very wrong.
All right. Once again, this is Live Arts Radio with more of accountability.
Really? Because I'm pretty sure I've already closed this account.
What are you talking about?
Look. This account's been processed exactly the same as 769QE2.
It can't be exactly the same. It probably just looks...
And account 23FH94.
That's just a coincidence.
And look at that. Account 45BHS95.
That can't be right. I open those accounts on opposite sides of the U.S.
Let's see. Liberal arts major, job in human resources, three children, two miscarriages. Always talks about that novel she's going to write. Addicted to reality TV. Contracts ovarian cancer. At which point, of course, it comes to me.
Look, we've got a lot of accounts. Of course, I'm going to process some of them along similar lines. There's only so many patterns.
But they're not exactly the same.
Except for the address. All 1.2 million of them.
What?
Why are you doing this?
Let me see that. Oh, my God.
And we've got 2.4 million with factory job, plant closed, job outsourced to Asia, lives off disability checks, two children, doesn't speak to either, spends days watching ESPN.
What is this, Lachesis?
10 million were the last half of the account, just as Netflix. I'm sensing a theme.
Look, this isn't what you think.
And that's just the U.S. I've got 20 million in China with only child, fails government service test, menial labor in a textile plant, obsessed with Korean soap operas. How do you find the time to suck down belly button shots, burning the midnight oil this way?
How many accounts are in China? How many have we open, process, closed? Open, process, closed. They're a conformist society. They march in time.
Not like this. Not every detail. Not every moment of every day. Lockstep without deviation or choice?
6 million in Africa. Farm laborers dreams of going to the city and getting an education. Never gets farther than 10 kilometers from home. Loves watching football. I wonder if they're all Arsenal fans.
I sculpted each of these accounts out of flesh and thought in a billion years of evolution. By opening them, I made them a deal. That they'd take all the rage this office could sling at them, but they'd get a chance to become something remarkable. They were supposed to be unique.
Every account is a snowflake, perfectly and grotesquely unique. but take the smallest step back and they are totally indistinguishable, a blur of soft silence. You open them. Little white flakes spin alone through the void, then land and fuse in one soggy, faceless pile, where Atropos dissolves them into mud.
You don't have to like them, you have to do your job.
And you think they thank me for it? They're so grateful to be processed? When you open an account, all you see is potential. The high IQ, the musical talent, the curiosity. You never have to see that potential turn from a promise into a regret. Do you know how terrifying it is to cross the gap from your desk to mine? To step up to the dark ocean of limitless choices? To feel your breath turn to rocks because you have no idea what to do next?
But that's part of account development.
I'm not talking about childhood. I'm talking about every day, waking up with the weight of all the choices you've made and all the choices left to be made, pressing on your chest until you can't even get out of bed. It used to be simpler. Used to be we could pretty much copy and paste the data from the parent account. But now there are so many options, so many variables, so much freedom that it chokes you.
Oh, that's why the screen. To cut down on the variables. It's so elegant. Captive accounts were always your favorite, Lachesis. Slaves, servants, soldiers, makes things tidy. But that took force. And force was met by force. And these days, physical chains are so passe. So you made chains for the eyeballs. So many accounts I close, their faces are coated with flickering reflections.
I used to enslave them with what they hated. Now I enslave them with what they love. Isn't that better?
You robbed them of themselves.
I gave them comfort before closure. All you ever gave them was the promise of pain.
And you gave yourself some free weekends. Everybody wins. Yay.
We're back at 94.7 WPBC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, here to talk about the piece we just heard, or I should say joining us to talk about the piece we just heard is Jen Burstein. Jen is played the character Clotho in the piece we just heard. Jen is a local actor, singer, and dancer who performs with Guerrilla Theater, PVCC, UVA Jazz, and the Etna Latin Dance Troupes. She's also taught French around Charlottesville, including UVA, the Speak Language Center, and currently at Tandem Friends Schools, where she is a regular guest director in the Tandem Friends Winter One-Act Play Festival. Jen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Go back to you for a second, Lauren. You acted in the first piece that we heard, Love's a Racket, but you directed this piece. What was that like?
I really enjoyed it. I actually really enjoy directing. I like bossing people around. Jen can attest to that. This piece had actually been staged previously as part of a festival of shorts with the same cast, but we were able to switch up the casting and develop the script in a lot more detail. There was a lot of back and forth with Nathan, the playwright, in especially the end of the play. The end got a whole lot more attention, and I believe it turned out really well.
Jen, you've done acting on the stage before, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find the transition from stage to voice acting?
It was a really, really engaging challenge. When we did the same show live, there was a lot of coordinated blocking, a lot of physicality, particularly in the end of the play, which, as Lauren mentioned, went through several revisions and iterations. But being limited to really our voices alone, no gestures, no expressions, was a really big transition. So I think for all of us actors, working on sort of every single line, looking at very much like music direction, looking at cadence, we all became very aware of our own kinds of vocal patterns, a same kind of melody that we have in every sentence. So we really made a lot of effort, really looking at every line, looking at the rise and fall, the intonation and kind of music of it. So that was something that I think we all, acting in this piece, became very aware of, which certainly will transfer back to stage, making sure we don't fall into these kinds of patterns.
Now you mentioned cadence, and the piece has a very strong cadence, largely due to the sound effects that would go along with it, the background sounds. I understand you directed the sound effects. How did that work?
I did. We did a lot of brainstorming and a lot of experimenting. Our first thought with, you know, with digital music would be, could we just make these three sounds in a loop and play that? But what we were really looking for in this piece was an organicness of sound, something that we were very worried about with a stamp sound or in a regular rhythm. So we experimented with just with microphones, with just creating the sounds of what could a mic pick up. Could we just write on a piece of paper? We ended up with, you know, slapping pieces of paper in different ways. And what we were really going for, though, was this kind of shift between when sounds reflect characters' emotions, when they're working at a pace that reflects what they're thinking about or the action of the play, and when is the sound sort of just serving as a soundtrack, creating a soundscape that isn't really as perceivable. So I have a background in music, and in particular percussion. I did a lot of drum lines in school, and so I was very much hearing this in a particular kind of a drum groove, that when the work is going well, as it has for millennia, that the women mention, that there is a very solid, steady rhythm as normal pace that sometimes accelerates if they're feeling stressed or if a character is really taking time to think or to share something meaningful, their particular sound and part would fall out. So that was really fun for me to go through the script and sort of decide when is this business as usual, when is it this regular rhythm, versus when is something changing, and then the sounds would change with the script itself.
So the sound effects were actually a performance in a sense. You're listening to the playback of the story of the podcast, and then adding the sounds in real time.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Right. So we have the script running in our ears, and in the studio where we recorded, I did this with Corey Capron, who you spoke with, and Zach Beamer, who also worked with us. And each of us would be in a different sound booth with glass. So having myself in the center booth, I had one performer to my left in a separate sound booth, one to the right, and in the center, I really was using my hands and conducting stops and starts, when the rhythm should go. Sometimes even in a regular groove, it was very important to us not to step on lines with sounds. So of really listening for a word, cueing the sound, and there was a lot of micro directing in that. So it was very much like an orchestral performance.
We have just a minute or so left. I'd like to ask you both what it's like acting without an audience. You're in a studio. There's no clapping. There's no laughing. There's no interaction with the audience. Does that take away from the performance, do you feel?
I think you have to trust your director. I think the director and the producer are standing in for the audience, and you just have to rely on them to tell you the right direction to go.
Jen?
Lauren was a wonderful director. She says she loves buzzing people around. Well, I love being bossed around by Lauren. We had a really wonderful cast and a great director. And for me, I didn't feel that as much. I didn't feel that I needed the audience to have a very authentic and meaningful performance. That I think not having the audience, really being that this is such a small cast production, really just made me feel so much more tuned in to my fellow actors. So whereas when we performed this same play on stage, you know, you always have that awareness of the physical space you're in, how many people are in the audience, and you're adjusting your volume based on whether you got a good laugh or didn't. And, you know, in some ways that can take away from how sensitive you are to your fellow actors when you're managing both the audience and your coworkers in the office. So I think I felt so much more attuned to everyone, especially because we were working in a studio physically farther apart, unable to interact in the same way, that the kind of visual connections and just really listening to vocal acting, I think really made me feel so much more in tune with my fellow actors in a way that I would hope to keep more in a live production.
And with that, sadly, we are plumb out of time. Thanks to everyone from Live Arts Radio for coming in early on a Sunday morning to be with us. You can listen to this and every episode of The Wake Up Call at cevillepodcast.com. Rick Moore returns next Sunday at 11 a.m. when he'll talk with a representative of the Islamic Society of Central Virginia. Coming up at noon on 94.7 WPVC, it's El Club del Sabor. For the Sunday morning Wake Up Call, I'm Dan Gould. Thanks for listening.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.